We'll bring the meeting to order. Welcome everybody to the February 4th eWeb General Board meeting. We'll start with item number one. It's an agenda check. Do any of the commissioners have anything to add to it? Frank wants to say something before anybody else jumps in.
Just one item of note, President Mattel, legislative update item number seven. Jason will not be here, but he will be accessible by speakerphone. He is in Salem testifying on our behalf in favor of the cap and trade bill. So,
well, that seems like an acceptable excuse. Does anybody else?
In fact, he may be doing that about now. So,
well, good luck to him. We made some minor changes to the agenda just in the last 24 hours. Does anybody have any concerns, or can we move on? All right, seeing none, we'll move on to item number two, which is items from board members and general manager. We'll start to my right. John Brown, do you have anything to share?
I just attended the public meeting with the College Hill residents last Wednesday and listened to staff, I think, did an excellent job of a dialogue with the adjacent people and explained the project. And then there's concerns, but they started the dialogue now early, so those people will know about the magnitude of the construction project. So I thought it was a good outreach.
Well, thank you for attending. I don't have anything to add on my own behalf. Sonia?
Yes, I attended the 66th annual celebration of business event with Commissioner Brown. And then coming up this next month, attending the annual Black History Month dinner this coming Friday. There's the NAACP dinner 2 or 3 weeks from now, and then also the ELCOG dinner at the end of the month. So all of my Fridays are booked the rest of this month, it seems. Very excited to be able to participate in those and represent UWeb on behalf. That's all I have.
Thank you. That reminds me. I'll just jump in again. I am attending the annual APA event in Washington, D.C. as board president at the end of this month, so I'll report out on that next month. Go ahead, Dick.
Okay. Well, I will pass this evening.
I just have two things. I attended a Wayne Morse event on resiliency and disaster preparedness. Maybe it was last week or the week before, just a continuation of the programs that they've been putting on. And also, along with Commissioner Brown, attended the work session that Frank presented the bond issues at. And just something that jumped out at me from that is that they had a lot of questions. The City Council work session. The city councilors had a lot of questions for Frank regarding the bonds, but also just about eWeb in general. And I'm just wondering if something that we can talk about at a future time is just another way to provide maybe information or education to the city councilors, because it seemed like some of them were familiar with the scope of eWeb, but many of them weren't, or they had a lot of questions. And I think that if we were able to give them some kind of orientation or something, it might just help some of that relationship be a little smoother.
Yep. So our process, if you want to put that request out to be on an agenda, you just have to ask for support. If you get a majority, we'll add it to the – it's just a formal process we have to go through. We can add it to an agenda item in the future.
Great. Thank you.
President Mattel, just in follow-up on that, you know, one of the things that you and I have discussed in reference to this meeting is the state of the utility address and how we want to pursue that going forward. I would suggest one of the best ways to inform the City Council on a regular basis would be as part of the state of the utility address and do something like that for the City Council. It would be probably a limited amount of time, but it would potentially give the board president and myself an opportunity to bring the City Council up to speed on where we are with our strategic and operational objectives, as well as our quarterly meetings that we have with council leadership. So that'd be a suggestion. Other than that, I just wanted to thank staff for their participation at the Home and Garden Show a couple weeks ago. Helped a lot of people understand energy efficiency and opportunities that we offer with incentives. So, thank you. Thank you.
And there's an event tomorrow night, Frank. Would you remind us of it? I just remembered.
There is an event tomorrow night coordination with 350 Eugene. We're going to have a kind of a question answer and a present. I'm going to give a presentation on where we are relative to regional priorities, energy, and our supply planning, where we see our priorities relative to some pretty complex issues around carbon and energy, and that's tomorrow night at 5:30 right here. It's open to the public, and it'll be about a half an hour presentation and then probably an hour's worth of grilling after that. So I'll look forward to answering all those questions.
I plan to attend. Anybody else planning to attend on the board? We have two, three.
Yeah.
All right, sounds great. So, Mindy, if it's all right with you, on your behalf, I'll just raise the question to see if there's support.
Sure.
So I think it's a great suggestion to kind of figure out how to make better utility out of the state of the utility mm-hmm. and other ways to further inform the city council about our process and our activities. Is there support for kind of fleshing that out a little bit at a future meeting?
Yeah, I'd just like to say, historically, we board leadership used to go to council meetings quarterly and go to the forum and speak. I know I wouldn't wish that on anybody because you've got to wait in line, and now they take them randomly. You could be there till 9:30 waiting to speak for two minutes instead of three. But that's what we used to do years ago.
So is that a vote in support of 15 minutes?
Yeah, and, I'm fine. I'm fine with it. I'm just making a suggestion, Steve.
If commissioners would like, I can reach out to the city manager and put forth a regular occurrence, probably sometime in March, that would be a regular update, at least where we are with our annual objectives, if the board would be open to that.
Hold on just a second, Frank. Go ahead, Dick.
Oh, I support the thought. I think we've attempted in the past to do some of that through periodic joint meetings, which sometimes don't draw a lot of interest on their part. So I certainly would welcome an opportunity to find a more useful and effective way of communicating our information.
Well, and I do as well. I'm assuming, Mindy, you're going to support the
yep.
the motion. We are unanimous. Could and perhaps put 15 minutes on the agenda next time to sort of think through what we could pull together as a package, including some of the recommendations that Frank made. Anything else before we move forward? All righty. Next, excuse me. Next up is public input. Before we do that, actually, let me just take advantage of the moment to read the facility awareness safety briefing. This is a relatively new thing. Sort of a best practice that lots of organizations are taking advantage of. So I invite visitors to sign up at the public testimony table if they would like to speak. Remind visitors that we are only able to access the first floor of this building. The restrooms are down the hallway to the right. please take note of the exits. There are two here in this room, but there are also out the back and down the left to the hallway. And if we have an emergency for any reason, the assembly point is at the flagpole near the parking lot if an evacuation is warranted. Okay, moving into public input. I can't remember. Do I have to open up a public input? Mm-hmm. I am opening up the public input session. So as a reminder, I will just read the rules of the game here. Please state your name and optionally your address. It helps us keep track of which ward you're in. Speak firmly towards the microphone. Each speaker will be offered 3 minutes to present his or her testimony. Our board secretary, Ann Kaa, will keep time. Please see the presentation screen, which will indicate your time remaining. Chime will sound when you have 30 seconds remaining, followed by a series of beeps when your time has elapsed. After all testimony is heard, each commissioner will have an opportunity to speak if they so choose, although by policy we do not engage in a back-and-forth dialogue, although it does happen sometimes. Please note that failure of a commissioner to speak shall not be construed as support of or opposition to any speaker's testimony. And finally, if a question is presented by a speaker and the board does not provide an answer, an eWeb staff member will contact the speaker so that the question can be addressed at a later time. Okay, we have three folks signed up. First up is Jenny Bennett.
Hi. My name is Jenny Bennett, and I live at 469 Spyglass Drive. I'm in Ward 5 with John Brown. I'm here today as an executive at Summit Bank, and I'm here to thank the eWeb Board of Commissioners for keeping some of eWeb's deposit dollars locally at Summit. This was an initiative undertaken by the Board of Directors about 2 years ago, and we now have $3 million on deposit from eWeb at Summit, all is FDIC insured. Our interactions with the eWeb staff started with Susan Eicher, and they're now primarily with Aaron Ballmer from Accounting and Treasury. You guys have a really good finance team. For those of you who aren't familiar with Summit, we're a local business bank headquartered in Eugene. All of our banking decisions are made here. We were founded 16 years ago and have grown to 75 Eugene-based employees and colleagues. All of us work downtown, and almost all of our team resides in Eugene and our eWeb clients. The dollars deposited into Summit are invested right back into Eugene. In the past 3 years, Summit has donated $325,000 to Eugene-based nonprofits and 5,500 volunteer hours to local nonprofits such as Ophelia's Place, The Relief Nursery, Women's Space, Kids Sports, Cornerstone, Square One, and The Shed, to name a few. The money on deposit from eWeb has allowed us the opportunity to lend approximately 75% of your dollars back into small to medium-sized businesses based in Eugene. As our bank continues to grow, these dollars enable us to hire additional colleagues who either currently reside here or who are moving to Eugene and are future eWeb customers. On behalf of all of my colleagues at Summit, thank you for going local and so much for investing in our bank. We're very thankful. Have a good meeting, and please stop by sometime if you feel like coming in to say hi or for a tour.
Thank you, Jenny. Next up, we have Tana Shepherd, followed by Linda Hale.
Hi again. Tana Shepherd, Eugene 4J, teacher on special assignment, and I coordinate the eWeb grant. Just a couple of check-ins. Even though salmon season's over, I just like to let you know that we served over 60 teachers with nearly 2,000 kids, first through 12th grade. Super successful as usual, even with some of our obstacles with getting kids out of the building this year. I have been digging into emergency preparedness and trying to figure out how, like, where we are at our district level. We aren't doing so great, so I'm going to work with that. But that's just something I've been digging into. The big thing is the climate education piece. I don't know if you saw the paper on Monday, but we did get a front page thing, and that was nice. But I have about 30 to 40 teachers interested in coming together and working on a scope and sequence for climate education across our district. So then I will be able to dig in with our program, but if people aren't really teaching about that, it's kind of hard to support them. So I'm trying to help with that, and I'm building a pretty good team of colleagues to help with that. With that, with the grant renewal, 4J is allowing me to head up a climate action team with adults and students to assess our district and see where we're at with our sustainable practices and how to better support our students to take action or be innovative or whatever, but we kind of need to walk the walk or we can't really support our students. So there are student and adult teams with that, and that's underway. So that's pretty exciting. I do have a plan to go up to Portland Public to do an observation. They have some really great things happening in their district, and so that's actually next week, and so that's super exciting. And then just to end, the annual 23rd annual Solar Challenge is set for Saturday, May 30th, and of course everyone's invited, and we always need volunteers. So far we have 24 teachers from Springfield, Bethel, and Eugene, and we are going to open it up to some of the rural districts as well through the Lane ESD this year to see if we get some outreach in that way. So that's it, and thanks again for your support.
Thank you, Tana. Next we have Linda.
Hello, commissioners. My name is Linda Heil. I live at 215 Foxtail Drive. I am in Ward 2. And today is a red letter day for local climate activists. We started the day in Salem to thank the Department of State Lands for declining to give Pembina Corporation a fifth extension for the Jordan Cove project's removal fill permit. Pembina subsequently withdrew their application for this permit. This afternoon, we thanked the Lane County Board of Commissioners for passing a resolution structuring a climate action planning process. And this evening, I am here to thank you, to say thank you to Frank Lawson for reaching out to 350 Eugene and scheduling a public forum about Eugene's energy future. We invite everyone to this event tomorrow night at 5:30 here in this room, as you have mentioned. We look forward to hearing what Mr. Lawson has to say in his prepared remarks and in answer to our group's questions. I'm assuming 350 Eugene fits into the IRP's communication and education rubric as a highly interested special interest group, and we applaud the direct outreach. I'll add a thank you to the Commission and eWeb staff for the 2021 IRP scope priorities, electrification, carbon mitigation, and evolving technology. We support the concept of learning and listening sessions to facilitate informed public feedback, as well as the traditional outreach measures like the Always Worth Reading pipeline newsletter. Thank you for specially including the future potential for rooftop and community solar, the role of storage and energy efficiency in rental housing stock in the discussion items in, of the themes and comments section. It's not uncommon that we have three events in one day, but never before have three events included thank yous to governmental bodies and utilities. This is progress. Might it be that humankind will manage to thread the needle of the climate emergency? We can keep working full steam ahead to do what's necessary to prevent climate and societal collapse, or we will end up doing horribly different things to respond to that collapse. Today gives me hope that we are making progress as a community to do what's necessary, and I say thank you to you all again.
All right, thank you. Does anybody else wish to speak before we close out the public input session? All right, hearing none, I'm going to close the public input session and invite my fellow commissioners to respond. Commissioner Schlossberg, you are first.
Just thank you, everybody, for your public testimony.
I, too, appreciate the testimony tonight.
I already put the event reminder in my calendar about May 30th, and we'll try to be there tomorrow night. Looking forward to the event. So. Okay.
I'll just briefly say I think that's the first time in the seven-plus years where all three folks who gave public testimony were here to essentially thank the board. I don't think that's ever happened before. It's very much appreciated. Yeah, please come back and do it again.
Yeah, and I'll just add, Jenny, thank you very much for reminding us that it makes a difference to invest locally. Tana, just so you know, salmon season's never over. You just stop catching them sometimes. And Linda, thank you very much for the kind words. It's like Steve said, it's really nice to have people come up and say thank you and this is how we move forward and work together. We really appreciate that attitude. Thank you very much.
Frank, do you have anything to add?
We'll see if Linda thanks me after tomorrow night or not. I've just, that will, you know, this is, no, I appreciate it as well.
All righty. Well, we will move on to item four. That's the approval of the consent calendar. Before we do, does anybody have anything they want to pull? John Brown.
I'd like to pull number six for explanation, please.
All right, we are pulling number six. Any others? All right, in that case, I move to approve the balance of the consent calendar minus item number six. Is there a second?
Second.
Third.
I think Dick had it by a hair. Dick Helgeson, we're going to count as the second. All those in favor, please raise your hand and say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Any opposed? None. Okay, let's take item number six. John, it's yours.
Just, I don't know if this is Carl or Wally or whoever. I see him back there. Somebody lost a bet. Anyhow, I just need explanation on that. I'm going to approve it, but I just, because we got all sideways last time we did one of these contracts, and I'm not so sure I understood the explanation. So my two points were that we're going to do a timber management plan on timber we don't own, and we passed on buying, and it's not a big significant amount of money, but we're still going to plan somebody else's timber. Is that correct?
I'm not sure we're actually, it's not an effort to plan the timber. It's more just bringing in the data from that property so we have a complete picture of what we have under ownership. Now, we have a future to purchase that timber if we choose so to do that. And then maybe work with the owner to maybe capture what his plans are. But we're not, it's a very small item just to bring in the data associated with that tax lot into our plan.
So we're not doing a cruise, we're just doing a GIS inventory?
No, the cruise are already done as part of that sale, so we can incorporate that data.
Okay. And then the other part of it, it's last time what got us a little bit sideways is that the contract was from a small amount like this one, but it included a percentage of the timber revenue when they sold it, and we didn't know what the timber revenue was. I think it was like $900,000. It was a lot of money. Their contract wasn't, but they got a percentage of it. So how was that dollar amount factored into this contract? I know they get a percentage. This company we're leaving the contract with gets a percentage of what we sell the timber for, and timber prices fluctuate from $500,000 to $900,000. So how do we know how much money they're going to get?
Well, as part of the RFP process, and Sarah, you can chime in, we added, you know, that was evaluated as far as the cost, and so they were the lowest commission that was in the RFP. And then basically we just assumed an amount to basically look at what this ask is as far as this contract. Isn't that correct?
Yeah, and so when we brought it to the board 5 years ago, mm-hmm. we did not include the commission as part of what the expected total value of the contract was.
Right.
That is included in the $145,000.
So their commission is part of the $145,000.
That's correct.
And so it's a five-year contract that's approximately $30,000 a year.
Yes. So it's estimated based on what the actual timber revenue will be.
Okay, so the $145,000 does include a percentage of what you think that revenue is going to be whenever they sell it.
That's correct.
Okay, thank you. And that's, you've answered all my questions. I appreciate it. I'm moved to adopt number 6.
We have a second?
Second.
A second by Commissioner Schlossberg. All those in favor, please raise your hand and say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? All right, passes unanimously. All right, that takes care of item number 4 and 5. Next up is number 6.
Oh, can I make one comment?
Yes, please do.
I asked a question about the different bidders in there because I want to make sure that we're looking out for bidders that are good for the community and are doing the right thing. I also think that there is some benefit. I noticed in the detail that we moved from having it listed to having each of the bids listed out to just having the range. And sometimes it's helpful for me to actually see where the median or the Lamode, I mean, if we're picking the lowest of the low and you can see that there's all of the other ones are grouped at the higher level, it kind of raises an eyebrow and you lose some of that data in just having the range. So no, if I don't want it to get too onerous in there, but I just wanted to put out there that that is helpful information, especially as we're dealing with multi-million dollar contracts. It seems like it would be useful for us to be able to see the more than just the range.
Yeah, Frank, Commissioner Carlson, we'll take that feedback certainly and try to improve the process. It will vary a little bit between an RFP and a bidding process where it's in an RFP, we're looking at a number of factors. We create a scorecard, so it could include a number of different items, not just price. And so, but your points are well taken.
Can we see those scorecards? I'd like to see those scorecards occasionally. Just, I mean, again, they're multi-million dollar contracts.
Yeah, we can provide various levels of detail depending on the we develop a new one for each RFP, and so I'll work with Sarah and we'll see what we can come up with.
Okay, thank you. Okay.
All right, moving on to item number 6. It's the annual state of the utility address. I'll hand copies of it down that way. Well, all right. As the board president, it's my duty to deliver the annual state of the utility address. Before I do, I just wanted to say that Frank and I spoke about this a little bit, and we decided to modify the process and this year so that we're in a transition year, giving it a try, where the board president will essentially summarize some of the progress made or the progress made in the past year. And that automatically leads into an opportunity for the general manager to respond with goals for the coming year. We may just want to further modify that, but I think it can be taken up when we have that discussion item that Mindy asked for at the March meeting. All right, well, without any further ado, let me just read the state of the utility. As Oregon's largest public utility and recipient of numerous awards, EWEB continues to be a strong and resilient institution. Our foundation of excellence is the delivery of clean water and clean power at affordable rates day in and day out. We stand as an important example of what public ownership and local control can achieve. In 2019, EWEB made steady progress on immediate needs as well as the long-term goals outlined in the strategic plan. Noteworthy areas of focus include rates. This is the fifth out of the past 6 years without an increase in electric rates, and it's the third consecutive year of no water increases. As a result, our electric prices are now middle of the pack when compared to 16 peer utilities in the Northwest, and water rates are the lowest in the region. I can remember being shown a rate projection back in 2013 when I first joined this board, outlining 3% rate increases per year until at least 2020. And had the board agreed to it, rates today would be approximately 25% higher than they are, and we would likely be facing an outraged community. Instead, the board rejected that path and focused on cost. This required some significant change, some of it very painful for our organization, but we are much better off as a result now. Customer confidence is increasing. EWEB's products and are more affordable today than at any time in the past decade. Next is resiliency. Power outage duration and frequency remains very low. And while we know we have more to do to speed response time, especially after major winter storms, we have made significant investments this past year to prepare for and respond to a major earthquake, winter storms, and other unplanned disruptions. Some of these include completing 9 of 16 FEMA-funded projects, installing 3 emergency water sites, a board resolution to explore water resiliency partnership opportunities with SUB, the launch of the Pledge to Prepare campaign, and updates to our education grant, which added emergency preparedness to the list of fundable projects. Number 3, responsible management of our assets. We own and manage nearly $1 billion in assets on behalf of our customers and spend millions each year maintaining and renewing them. Some projects we completed in 2019 include adding an on-site chlorination process to the Hayden Bridge treatment plant, FERC relicensing of the Carmen Smith Dam, rebuilding the Carmen Powerhouse and substation, moving toward completion of the rock consolidation, sale of our stake in the Foot Creek Wind Farm, and cleanup of the historic MGP site. 4, on energy and climate, we achieved the following this past year. As required by our energy resource plan, EWEB offset 100% of projected new load growth with conservation during 2019. 26% of residential energy savings achieved, and about 2/3 of residential incentives occurred in limited income dwellings. Our conservation program portfolio was expanded in 2019 without budget increases. We added electric vehicle charging rebates, generator loans, electric service line upgrade loans, and limited income energy efficiency education. On the legislative front, EWEB supported HB 2020. That's the failed carbon pricing bill. It's an economy-wide carbon pricing bill. But we plan to support the updated version during the current short session. Finally, something particularly important to me, we reviewed and reformed our low-income support programs. Significant changes to its administration resulted in less overhead and more direct benefit to the customers. The customer care budget had $950,000 in it, but was increased to $1.2 million. As a result, assistance went from $200 to $260 per low-income household. Also, data shows we're processing most applications within 3 business days, and which is a significant improvement over a past year. Sometimes it took months. Since implementation in February 2019, 499 limited income or at-risk homes have received home energy audits, which are free to them, and have been equipped with basic efficiency and emergency preparedness items. More recently, we reduced system development charges for ADUs and formalized and streamlined administration of an SDC waiver program. It's important to remind ourselves that we're still in the midst of a lot of change. There are significant opportunities to further integrate IT into our processes. We have big decisions to make regarding the future of our Mackenzie dams this year. Decarbonizing the grid and resource adequacy are complicated regional issues that our staff have to grapple with. Helping our low-income renters and homeowners take advantage of conservation and efficiency programs is an enduring challenge. We have plenty to do this year. But I can say with confidence that EWEB is a great organization that Eugenians can take pride in. I'm very much looking forward to working with the board and supporting our general manager and staff as we deliver water, power, and excellence to our customers in 2020. Our general manager, Frank Lawson, will now outline his goals to move these and other issues forward this year. Thanks, Frank.
Thank you, President Mattel. So it really does naturally get back to the idea that the work is never done. The first few goals actually recognize the tension that we have between keeping the lights on and the water flowing and also taking a step back to look at our operations strategically. The first goal is, in essence, run the utility as the board instructs us. There are numerous resolutions, policies, and guidelines, and we use a number of different key performance indicators or metrics along the way, everything from reliability metrics to water quality metrics. For example, we do 85,000 drinking water samples every year. There are a number of different metrics we also include around workforce engagement, cybersecurity, reliability. These are all things that are important to the day-to-day operation that we and the responsibility that we have to this community. By doing that well, we earn the right to pursue more strategic endeavors. A number of those have to do with customer confidence. They have to do with investments in technology that will facilitate further integration of renewable resources and other objectives that we have as a community. We are looking to make sure that this technology works effectively, both from, in this case, a metering perspective, as well as looking to increase our ability to service customers through easy-to-service bills, through new self-service options as well. We have on the order of 1.5 to 2.5 million interactions with customers every year. Emergency preparedness is a really critical part of what we're doing, and it's our ability to continue to provide vital products and services in the midst of a number of different challenges or threats. Some of the ones that we think of most often include seismic events or earthquakes, but there's also cyber attacks, there's chemical spills, there's a number of different threats that both physical and cyber that we are faced with. And we have to be prepared, we have to be resilient, independent of any of those threats. The community relies on us for vital products and services, and we need to be able to be prepared to be resilient to those as well as recover from those. Based on commissioner feedback between last meeting and this meeting, we added the outage management component to this back in. That's an ongoing improvement process that we're working on, as well as a wildfire mitigation plan. And this is something that we felt was important given all of the issues with PG&E in California and all of the issues and work that we do with other utilities that are more rural than we are, but we have an urban forest as well that we need to make sure that we're prepared for. And then based on direction from you, the commissioners. We have had a number of working meetings, and we are collaborating with Springfield Utility Board around how to approach drinking water resiliency from more of a regional perspective. So that includes interties, potential second sources, and how we will be able to support both communities in the event that one of the utilities or both of the utilities should suffer some kind of setback or inability to deliver water. And so emergency preparedness is one of our two big strategic pillars for this coming year as well as several years. Electric resource decisions, you'll hear a little bit about that tonight. We've actually expanded its definition a bit, calling it electricity supply planning. Historically, an integrated resource plan, or IRP, was part of that. We know that there are some other components to it. It includes synchronizing of our resources with our load. We want to look at various different scenarios going forward, including the impact of further electrification, as well as evaluating some specific assets, such as you mentioned, the Leeburg and Walterville facilities. And then, which is that goal number 7, to specifically look at those assets and develop a preliminary path going forward. Those are incredibly important, not just as generating facilities, but they have a huge impact on the community and the environment up the McKenzie Valley, and we want to make sure that we're covering all the bases there. And then finally, we've started this last year, and this was a way that we could look at our own operations to reduce our own climate greenhouse gas footprint, as well as what we're facilitating with customers. This does not include what is contained in our electricity supply or our own fleet at this point. Most of this is through energy efficiency. The cleanest energy is the energy not used. And so conservation, energy efficiency, electrification, the metric tons there is simply a jump-off point based on where we ended last year. This number over time will just continue to grow. And so we felt it was important as part of our climate change policy not just to look at our own resources and our own position on legislative issues, but what are we actually doing to help our community reduce its greenhouse gas footprint. And so the work continues. We earn the right to pursue strategic endeavors by our ability to day in and day out deliver electricity and water safely, reliably, and affordably. And while I'd like to say the work might get done at some point, I don't think it will. This is our customer's resource, and we are obligated and responsible for continuing this work. Thank you.
All right, we have 16 minutes left on the clock for this item. If anybody has any feedback for Frank, remind us that we kind of reviewed these last month and people had some time during their one-on-ones, but there's still time remaining for any feedback or follow-up. I'll open up a queue. Sonia.
I just wanted to comment how excited I am that 26% of the residential energy savings went to two-thirds of the residential incentives occurred in the limited income dwellings. I really appreciated getting that feedback. I know it's something that I've been hammering quite a bit about, and just it's really helpful for me to see some of that progress. So thank you for outlining that. And I'm also really happy to see that we were able to increase the assistance to $260 from $200. So those are some of the statistics that jumped out at me. And thank you for outlining kind of the path forward and where we want to go. I agree with the goals that have been outlined and think that we do have a lot of work, but I think it's the right work. So thank you.
I'll just jump in. I don't think I said so in the state of the utility itself. The work reflects the achievements and the success reflects the work of staff, many of whom are here in the room today, and direction from the general manager. So thank you all for what was really a good year. Thank you. All right, we will move on. The next item is the legislative update and with Jason. I guess we have to do a call-in. I'm going to probably screw this.
I think it's 40 minutes off of the time.
Thank you. Good reminder. Let's see. So we were scheduled to do that at 6:50. It's only 10 past. Let's see what we could do.
Steve, President Mattel, I just got a text. Jason just finished testifying. So
lucky for us. Put him on the spot quickly.
Does anybody know how to? I don't really want to be the one to mess with the technology. You know how to use this? And would you?
I don't know. I'll mess with it. Sure. What the heck?
Jason, it's Steve Mattel and the rest of the board and 50 or so other people in the room. Are you ready?
Good evening.
Yep.
Live from the Capitol.
Wonderful. Well, are you ready to go? We know we're starting some 30 minutes earlier than we had originally planned. Is that okay with you?
Yeah, I just got done testifying, so I'm available.
All right. Well, then we are queuing up 15 minutes for you to give us an update on our legislative agenda for the year, for the session. Please go ahead.
Oh, okay, folks. Well, I didn't necessarily have a real big formal presentation planned. I was planning to take any questions, but I can probably jump in and ad lib. First and foremost, this evening, the carbon legislation had its first public hearing, and we're in hour three here, and moving towards hour four. It's quite a bit of the same. There have been a lot of changes made to the bill to continue to garner political support. We don't think that our position of support needs to be changed because the portions of the electric sector seem to be relatively unchanged. And most of the changes that are being done, the state of Oregon is retiring allowances that cover any phase-ins or delays or exemptions. And as long as the state does that, that means they're living within their carbon budget. And that's important for two reasons. It means that the state of Oregon is not compromising any of the emission reduction goals in the bill. It also means we preserve an opportunity to link to California. And that is very important to UM. We think we're on track for those two things. So our position of support remains unchanged at this time, and we're going to monitor the amendments, but I don't expect that recommendation to change. Unless there's any questions on that bill, I'll go ahead and move on to the second major priority, wildfire mitigation.
Take it with you.
I'm happy to report that the latest amendment that came out today, I think, lives up to the principles and goals we set forth. Number one, most of the decision-making is going to remain in the hands of UF's elected board. And also, there's a directive from the state to use a risk-based approach to whatever UF would put into a plan that we need to have adopted by December of 2021. The risk-based criteria is very important because risk could be very different in different parts of the state. Obviously, the risk level that UEB faces in the Lehigh Valley is very, very different from the risk level of Southern Oregon or, say, the Hood River area. So we feel good about the direction that's going. And this also leaves the door open for the state to listen carefully to four workshops that the Oregon Public Utility Commission will hold in the rest of 2020 to better inform what the best practices are in the electric sector for wildfire mitigation. And then if necessary, the legislature could come back in 2021 and potentially add some more details as far as utility responsibilities for wildfire mitigation. And our big concern was we wanted to make sure the state waited for those four workshops to unfold. And you had plans to participate in those four workshops. Moving along, I guess I can take questions at the end after I'm done.
Yeah, that's what we'll do. There's a couple that are queuing up, but we'll do them at the end.
Okay, great. Then moving along, I think it's House Bill 4135. I haven't got all my bill numbers memorized yet, but that was a bill that was of concern because it directed UEB, mandated, I should say, that UEB would have to require collect 1% of our retail revenues and dedicate that towards investments to accelerate the electrification of transportation. That's a fairly unprecedented reach into rate making, which has always been the exclusive domain of the elected boards of consumer and utilities. So that was the basis of staff's recommendation of opposition. I'm happy to report that an amendment released, I guess it was last night, we saw it for the first time. It was an amendment that has removed that mandate, and it no longer would involve any ratepayer dollars. The only directive that remains in the bill is it would provide direction that UEB would need to use any proceeds from the sale of low-carbon fuel standard credits to accelerate the electrification of transportation. Those are not ratepayer dollars. Those are a thing of value that was created by a statewide program to reduce the carbon intensity in the transportation sector. So I think the staff recommendation is, with that change to the bill, that removes any basis of opposition. And then finally, the last item is a bill that would reach into how local governments do procurement in-house or out of house externally on piping materials used in water supply projects. There's a big concern. We don't see any reason for this bill, and there are good reasons why utilities might exclude certain piping materials. We think we're the best judges of what materials work well or don't work well in different parts of our system. There are some examples where we actually have used plastic pipe, but there's a variety of other areas of our system that plastic piping would be very undesirable. Some of the things I've heard about plastic piping that makes it a bad fit are it's less accurate for leak detection, so there's water conservation concerns. That also, as far as leaking, there could be increased risk to public health if plastic pipes were used in certain vulnerable conditions. And lastly, we have our crews trained to use different piping materials. Training would be more complicated if we had to train all of our employees to use many different types of materials. Standardization has some benefits for training, the type of equipment that's used for installation. We don't want to have 4 or 5 different sets of equipment. So there's some benefits of standardization that we want to use only as many materials, piping materials, as we really need to. And that bill, I'm pretty confident that bill does not stand much of a chance of passage. I'm not even certain it'll get a hearing.
All right. Well, thank you for the summary, Jason. I'm going to open up a queue. I think Sonia's in it first and then Mindy second. Go ahead, Sonia.
Hi, Jason. Thanks for taking the time after directly testifying on the bill we support. On the climate change bill, the carbon cap bill, I got word from a little bird that there was a chance that this bill wouldn't be able to, that if this bill passes, that it wouldn't be able to connect Oregon to California and Washington. Can you talk a little bit about that? And is that changed in some way? I know that I heard this a few days ago, yeah. So anything is possible in a couple hours' time at the Capitol.
Yeah, well, first off, I would say any statement you hear from anyone, including me, is at best an educated guess and speculative. Linkage, in like say we're talking about climate initiatives in California and the other Canadian provinces that are members, linkage is an art. It is an art, and the only thing that the WCI accord or whatever it is that is sort of the basis of linkage, the only thing it says is programs must be of equivalent stringency, but that is subject to a lot of interpretation and judgment calls. And I think, for example, I think it was must have been Alberta I think Alberta certainly did some customizing in their program, and they were allowed to link. So I feel like there's still a good avenue for the state of Oregon to link. I can understand why it's not as clear-cut as it might have been with the bill, House Bill 2020 from last session. I think had a much clearer path to linkage, but I don't believe there's any reason to believe we can't stick the landing for linkage to California and the other programs. And it is worth pointing out, would be the second state in to have an economy-wide carbon pricing program. And any of the changes they've made, they are retiring allowances out of the economy-wide cap, so they're still living within their carbon budget. And I really do believe California would not want it to come to that. I think they will find a way to work with Oregon for linkage. That's just my educated guess, though.
Okay. Thank you. I appreciate that. There was some concern posted to me that if we couldn't do that, then it may not be worth doing the bill, which I thought was a little bit extreme. But I do hope that there is a path forward to be able to do that and a path forward to passing it in this very short session. And then on 4135, I understand your or the staff's recommendation to originally oppose that bill. I do have sort of and I understand again why staff recommended opposing it. But on the outset of that bill, it seemed like it was in line with the general concept is in line with what we would support. I mean, we are in support of electrifying the grid and fuel switching. So at first it seemed a bit counterintuitive to me. I do understand the rate position. I'm not sure that we have taken a stance as a board on when those sorts of issues, when the local control outweighs the other policy issue at play, because if this is something we're truly committed to, maybe in this one instance, it's something that, you know, we as a board say, yes, we do support it because it's so important to mitigate climate change and to get EVs moving more. So I don't know. It's just something that I'm putting out there as something for all of us to consider as we approve or don't approve certain stances on bills. Okay, that's all I have.
All right. I'm just noticing we're out of time for this piece, but I think there are some questions remaining. Does anybody have a problem with adding 10 minutes to the clock? We're way ahead of time generally.
No, I'm good.
All right. If you don't mind, Ann, just putting 10 minutes back on. Mindy, you are up, and then Dick, you're next.
All right. My question is a general question about how it's decided what we support or oppose. And I see that. So we're being asked tonight to recommend the staff is recommending that we take action to add something to our legislative agenda. And are these decisions that have been made in previous years what to support or not? Did it happen in this past year? And I just don't remember because my brain was so overloaded with trying to remember all the information that I was just learning. How does it get decided?
I'm going to answer that. So this is an agenda item for action. So we are being presented a list of four bills that staff think we ought to be focusing and paying attention to and the positions we ought to take. After this discussion, we will take a vote. If anybody wants to propose an amendment to that or change those four, this is the time to do it.
So the part where it just says so we're being asked to approve all of these, not just House Bill 4043. Is that correct?
If I could, Commissioners, three of these bills actually we adopted positions on as part of our agenda at the December 6th board meeting. So three of these items were originally going to be updates through correspondence, but there's the fourth bill, the plastic piping bill. That was a bill we didn't know about, and it seemed important enough to add to our legislative agenda, which would require an action this evening.
Okay, great. So the answer is that we did discuss this, and it was all part of my steep learning curve that I don't remember. So thank you.
All right. Dick, go ahead.
On that previous point, my experience is that we basically set the context for the session by reviewing the principles and values that we have traditionally used as kind of the parameters that that we work with in order to determine how to relate to any given bill, that we give staff considerable deference in kind of managing the process throughout the session as to how those get applied, and where there are questions, they typically come back to us, and we work it a little bit. But typically, in my experience, it's been fairly clear how things fall with respect to those principles, and maybe some of those are assumed at this point and ought to be more overtly referenced in the conversation. I think I wanted to comment on the certainly, I think we ought to oppose the water pipe materials. I think from my standpoint, any bill that favors a particular industry or is sponsored by an industry in order to get a leg up on you know, the use of their products is kind of a misformed purpose for legislation. And well, I certainly would hope that from an engineering standpoint, we would consider all options out there, you know, relative to our standards and our uses of materials and our infrastructure. You know, I just can't see us supporting this bill. With respect to electrification, so I know that's something that has an affinity with our values and our sense of urgency and interest in the community, but I would just remind us that we are not a funding source for any and all good things, and that, you know, there are important aspects of local control that we've been able to exercise through the years while being true to those values. So, for example, conservation is a thing that we've, for over 30 years, invested in very heavily on behalf of the community, even to the extent well beyond that of other utilities. We have pledged as much as 5% of our revenues over a long period of time to that purpose. And we've been able to do that in a way that aligned with community values without there being a state-level mandate. We've also had the ability to ramp that back at times when it made sense to do so, both financially and otherwise. So, well, I certainly appreciate the point that this and other worthy purposes can align with our values. I think that attribute of local control is important. And I would like to have further conversation as to what electrification looks like and what the utility's role is and what utility purpose is being served, how that affects our anticipated loads going forward, what that looks like in terms of providing resources to meet that need, and what, if any, cost there is that would be absorbed in the rates for doing so. And I don't mean to state that as something that is an obstacle, but I just don't think we're particularly well informed as to what the implications are. Well, I think in general, it's something that we can support.
I think that latter item is something that's coming up really in the next agenda item, right through the ESP and the IERP, whatever they're calling it today. Frank, go ahead if you wanted to respond.
Yeah, I was just going to jump in on a process point. First of all, going into any session, we try to outline what we think the key bills are going to be, the ones that have a certain degree of anticipation or knowledge of, and we try to reach out to the board and get the board's position on those very specifically. Where the values come in is that, as you can even tell today, sometimes things move very quickly in the legislative session, and we want staff to be able to make some determination based on the values that the board generally puts forth. One example is the electrification funding, and it's a really good example because there is nothing that prevents this board from taking action around electrification for this community. The question that Jason has wrestled with some is, do we want Salem dictating both our rates and how we budget our money? That's one where the board historically has said, no, that's our jurisdiction. There's nothing that prevents us from making these investments. We do support electrification of transportation and other forms of electrification. And so it isn't necessarily that we are against the outcome, but do we want to fund projects in LaGrande or in some other part of the state based on some general fund? So that's where, now it's a little different now because it was revised. Now it has to do very specifically with the revenue achieved by clean energy fuel credits, which we receive as an aggregator. And it would make sense that if that is the purpose for collecting those funds, that we would indeed use those funds for that purpose. So it it does make a lot more sense now that has been changed.
Jason, I'm going to jump in with a question, really following on Frank's comments with regard to HB 4135. So as you described, they did amend it, and now they are saying just money from the Clean Fuels Program would be directed to be spent on EV charging. Is that 100, all of it, or do we have any discretion with how those funds are spent? Because right now we don't spend 100% of it that way. We use some for education and outreach and other ways of incentivizing people to consider purchasing an EV. We don't just incentivize charging systems.
It looks like 100%, but it has expanded language that makes it far more encompassing and flexible as to what acceptable uses of the funds are. And I expect we're going to make sure some legislators say that on the record just so we can demonstrate legislative intent. But I think it would be very broad and encompassing that flexibility. You know, it could include marketing materials, a billboard about the benefits of EVs. I think it's got quite a bit of flexibility now.
Okay. Well, I would want to be assured of that because I just like has been said, I prefer our judgment over how best to spend those dollars to incentivize EVs than to have somebody in Salem tell us that it has to be done in a prescriptive kind of way. But it sounds like you're assuring us of that. I'll move on. John, do you have anything you want to bring into it? Any final questions or comments? All right, then we do have an action to take. Jason, I think what the action is regards only legislative concept 199 slash House Bill 4043, the very last one. The rest, as you just mentioned, had been voted on previously.
That's correct. The plastic piping bill is the only bill that requires action.
All right. I will try and summarize the action. So all those in favor of taking a position against LC 199 HB 4043, please raise your hand and signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any for? All right. Well, we have a unanimous support for the staff position. I think we're done with the item, unless you have any last words of wisdom for us, Jason.
No, wish us luck on the cap and trade bill. We need all the legislators to stay in the Capitol and vote on it.
All right. Well, best of luck to you. Thanks again.
Good luck with that, Jason.
Thank you.
All right, we are moving on to item number 8, and that's the Integrated Resource Plan Scope and Scenarios. It's Susan Ackerman and team. Susan, if you want to introduce who you're bringing up, that'd be great.
This is going to be awkward.
Yeah, that's fine. Yeah, make the busy
scene. Good evening, Commissioners. I'm Susan Ackerman, and with me to the far left, your far right, is Jen Connors of our communications team and Megan Capper, who is our power planning supervisor. Just a reminder, we talked to you in one-on-one meetings last fall about your expectations and interest in the upcoming IRP process. And the purpose of what we want to do today is to catch you up on where we are. But there is an awful lot of material here, and so on Frank's suggestion, we have decided that we will cover the substantive aspects of what we're doing first with Megan Capper, give you time to ask questions, take a break, and then come back, and Jen will take up the public engagement part of the plan. So that's our plans for tonight. Megan?
Great, thank you. As Susan mentioned, I'm going to talk about the Integrated Resource Plan tonight. I'm going to start with talking about the Integrated Resource Plan in the context of electricity supply planning, and then I'm going to move to the status of our scope and scenario definitions, and then I'm going to conclude with the next steps. One of our objectives is to inform you about the Integrated Resource Plan. work, and it's also to listen to your feedback. It's really important for us to hear you and to have some key takeaways. We have a couple questions we're going to want to ask you at the end, so thought we would highlight them to see if you have any concerns or questions around our scope and scenarios, and then see if additional information could be helpful for you. So we'll revisit those at the end of the presentation. Ultimately, we really want to position you to be advocates for our processes and our outcomes. So to get started, this diagram shows the relationship between the elements of electricity supply planning and the integrated resource plan, how they differ, yet how they work together. Electricity supply planning is the holistic approach to ensuring that we provide reliable, affordable, and low-cost electricity to our customers. A subset of electricity supply planning is our resource mix, and that is guided by our integrated resource plan. So the IRP is a subset of the electricity supply planning. Another piece of electricity supply planning is our individual resource valuation. I call that out specifically because I know some of you have had questions about how our Lieberg-Walterville analysis aligns with the integrated resource plan. So I'm going to take a step back from the IRP, and we're going to talk about the Lieberg-Walterville for a moment. As you know, our Lieberg-Walterville resource requires action before the final 2021 integrated resource plan is complete. Patty Boyle, who is managing this work, has a cross-functional team made up of generation, finance, and power planning staff who will conduct this evaluation. This work happens in parallel with the IRP process and will use many of the same assumptions like carbon pricing, hydro conditions. However, the Lieberg-Walterville analysis will include other asset-specific factors such as social and community benefits. The outcomes of the Lieberg-Walterville analysis will be incorporated into the 2020 IRP, so we can look at it from a portfolio perspective. And you can see in the middle there, as the circles align, that we'll want to make sure that we are still maintaining our RPS obligations and things like resource adequacy on a portfolio perspective. So now I'm going to go back, and we're going to now talk about the IRP and our phases in the timeline. You have all seen these phases. We shared with them with you last fall. And given the complexity around this work, we wanted to talk to you about it in a way that all stakeholders could understand. One way to do that is to offer an analogy. So we're going to talk about this in terms of a ship analogy, like going on an ocean voyage. If you look up on the left-hand side, we have the scoping phase. This would be when we determine the focus of our voyage. Are we going on an Atlantic voyage, or are we going on going to the Pacific? It's really the direction we're going in. For an IRP, this is where we decide what's important. What is that focus that we want to take in our IRP cycle? In the forecasting phase, we prepare the waters that we think we might encounter. Are we going to encounter rough, choppy waters or violent sea waves? In the IRP, this is where we make assumptions about our future. You can see up here we have what are the assumptions around legislation or climate change. Our third phase is modeling, and this is where we control the dashboard, the dials to chart our course options. For example, on a ship's dashboard, we might want to control the dials to see how long we can cruise without refueling. Here, you can see up here, for the IRP, we call those dials our assumptions. One dial might be controlling for the load and another for our hydro conditions. You'll also hear us talk about sensitivities. We refer to each click of the dial, the impact of that click, we're referring to as sensitivities. Of course, we can adjust those dials according to new information in the situation as it changes. Once we've programmed the ship's navigation system, we hit compute, and the tools give us our course options. During our action phase, we can choose our optimal course based on what's important. In the ship analogy, we either have to decide, is it more important to get there as fast as possible, or is it more important to get to our destination while visiting many islands? For the IRP, we'll have to weigh and look at the trade-offs of how important is a low carbon compared to cost, compared to reliability. Like all complex decisions, we will need to make trade-offs of numerous values. So what does this all tell us in the end? This is an important thing to talk about because when we were out working with stakeholders, we would hear the misconception that the IRP will tell us what our future portfolio should be. This is not the case, nor will it tell us what to do with specific assets like Lieberg-Walterville. What it will do is it will tell us if we have gaps in our resource needs, and it will give us a variety of portfolio options to meet those needs. It will also give us information to evaluate those options, once again, about portfolio costs, reliability, carbon impacts. Finally, the outcome of an integrated resource plan is a strategy and associated action plan, things that we need to do now to set us on a path to meet our long-term objectives, our strategic plan. So let me bring this back to where we are in our IREP process. Today, we have finished the scoping phase, and we've determined the focus. I'm going to walk you through the process and the results of our scoping phase. You'll recall last fall, we met with individual board members to initiate the scoping phase. We talked to you and staff, and we worked with our consultants to summarize your feedback back into groups. Over to the right of the slide, you'll see the 8 consistent themes that were the outcome of this process. We saw a lot of interest in battery storage and how electric vehicles would impact our grid. There was a lot of time spent on carbon mitigation, as well as questions around expiring resources. In your board packet, there's a full list of these themes and some of our notes around them. So now I'm going to move into where are we? Those 8 themes are a lot of themes for us to cover in one small IPR cycle. So given the time and resource constraints, we needed to prioritize them. We prioritized them based on how meaningful they were to stakeholders, how relevant to our current landscape, and how timely they were in the 2021 IRP. We narrowed the list to 3 major focus areas: carbon mitigation, electrification, and emerging technology. Our next step in order to analyze these 3 themes was to envision some future world where these focus areas might come to bear in different ways. We call these scenarios, and these are on the left-hand side of our slide. These aren't predictions, and EWEB isn't advocating for any of them. They are just possibilities that we want to explore to illuminate our 3 themes. So, what if things don't change a lot? What if we maintain current trends? We call this the steady state. This is the one at the top, and it's really a reference case for our other 2 scenarios. Our second, what if we have aggressive carbon legislation that impacts not only the electric sector, but also transportation and buildings, driving electrification through price incentives? We're calling that scenario climate forward. Finally, our third scenario, what if carbon legislation is limited to the electric sector? EV adoption doesn't take off, and there are price incentives to encourage electrification in the other sectors. We call that scenario sluggish electrification. So you have a handout in front of you that describes in a little bit more detail these scenarios, and there's a full list of the scenarios that we looked at in your board packet. So you may wonder, what happened to all those good themes that we gathered when we talked to you? Well, they're documented, and they will inform our scoping process for subsequent IRP cycles. It's important to point out here that under current conditions, we don't anticipate our supply-side resources will change as a result of this IRP cycle. That's why you see over under 2023 IRP the BPA product options. That's not timely until our next IRP. This is just what you have over here in the right is you have some possibilities for future scopes. But we still commit to you that we will go through every 2 years our reaching out, prioritizing, defining, and then communicating our scopes. So I'm going to take a in this process, we heard a lot about climate change and carbon. So I'm going to just take a moment and talk to you about how carbon climate change is going to be incorporated into our analytics. First of all, we've already talked about how our scenarios will assume some climate legislation is imposed. We'll also look at how fast or slow electrification occurs and the impacts of that, and then carbon impacts on our various portfolio options. And later in the process, the board will have the opportunity to weigh in on the importance of carbon compared to other such factors, portfolio costs, reliability, the things we've already talked about. We'll take a look at weather events and how they impact our load and our hydro dials. So putting that all together, you get a sense of the bigger picture from where we've been and the process we went through in order to define where we are today with the current definitions of our scope and our three scenarios, and then where we're going and how we really haven't lost sight of those other themes that we've talked to you about and how they could easily be scopes of our future IRPs. So now to conclude, here's the IRP process in a Gantt chart. And really what we've done, it's the same phases, but what we've done is added the stars to show when we plan on having board workshops. Our first workshop is April 14th. And by that time, staff will have completed the forecasting phase and we'll be able to talk to you about the range of assumptions that we have and other factors in the IRP. We're not going to move forward to our actual modeling until the board has an opportunity to understand where we are and provide your perspectives. So here are a couple of our near-term next steps. In the next month or two, we're going to provide you with background materials for in preparation of the board work session in April. And then early April, staff and we're going to be meeting with the board to discuss those materials. And then finally, we're going to have the work session on April 14th. So taking this back to the beginning, here are a couple questions that we would love to hear your feedback on, and that is if you have concerns or questions around the scopes or scenarios, and then also any information that we can provide you that might be helpful.
All righty. Well, thank you for the presentation. We'll open up a queue. Anybody would like to go first? Looks like Frank wants to go first.
I just wanted to say that there's one really significant change that is incorporated into this process, and that's that the cycle time. If you'll notice, every 2 years doing an IRP instead of every 10, we really need to get more dynamic in the ability to look at sensitivities and scenarios, and staff is working on the ability to do that. We think we know what the future's like, but you know what? We're going to be looking at something different on the next revision or the next revision, almost like I would use the analogy with the board, a lot like a long-term financial plan. We're able to look at, well, what does refinancing do for us, or what does a change in the capital plan look? Our integrated resource planning process, as part of looking at resources, looking at new products, looking at decisions coming up, will be a lot more active and a lot more often. And so that's a very significant change compared to our history.
Sonia has a question. Then John Brown.
Oh, just a quick comment on the timing of the Gantt chart. I just noticed that the finalization phase happens in Q1 of 2021, and then into Q4, but we will have a significant turnover in the board at that point, so that may be a little bit challenging with having some of these meetings happen and getting feedback in separate one-on-one sessions that I appreciate, but that does mean that new board members may need to have a significant amount of
good point
feedback into that process at some point.
I would say that's a great point. One of the things I would point out, depending on what happens in the spring election, we may know who the future board members are, and a lot like we did with Commissioner Schlossberg, we started an orientation throughout the summer. So depending on what happens this spring.
John, go ahead.
So help me, I hate to get in the weeds, but you brought up Leberg-Walterville, and just help me how you're going to deal with that. I mean, Leberg hasn't been running for 2 years. It's not going to run for at least a couple more, and we ran out of water in Walterville because we had, in 21 years, McKenzie's never been that low. How are you going to model that into our portfolio in the future because of some of those drastic changes that we've seen in the last 2 years?
Well, we currently, any information that we have, we currently put in our models today. So if we have it as a fact, it's currently into our models. When we're looking into the future with the decision that you guys make this year, that the board makes this year, we will then put that into the models as soon as we know what that decision is. Now, the how-to is something that we have, I'll have to get Will up here, but yeah, Will, Frank.
I would add to Megan's response is that when she refers to sensitivities, part of sensitivities is water. And so we would have to be able to model different water conditions as well as different load conditions. If summers are hotter, then we need to model for that. If we do have a certain amount, we have decades and decades worth of water history, but we also know that that's going to get pushed in a different direction going forward. So we'll have to incorporate that as part of the sensitivity within the model.
And then to follow up on that, I know that my first 6 or 8 years sitting here, we used to model on our budgeting for 85% water, and we've gone away from that because of the hedging, because of the Enron deal. And is that going to come back into play where we're going to consider that through the Columbia Treaty and all of those things about the supply with – because I know wasn't the contract with Canada up?
I think we're going to have to.
I would say, and to a certain extent, Commissioner Brown, you're mixing up a little bit how we financial model versus how we operate. We do incorporate a contribution margin risk factor within our finances, and that does contain a number of factors, including a 90% water versus 100%, and we typically take that out for the first five-year window. It also models lower revenue and lower prices in the wholesale market. So those in combination are part of the financial modeling, not necessarily how we would do a long-term integrated resource plan, which is going to be further out.
Thank you.
I'm going to jump in the queue for a moment. I have a couple of questions. So I have a concern that as we see more and more households putting in heat pumps and also heat pump water heaters, I guess I worry that we will start to get accustomed to, especially in the milder times of the year, a certain load profile that can change very rapidly once the temperature drops below a point at which those heat pumps work, and suddenly those things are all swapping over to resistance heating, and our load profile goes up potentially dramatically, and we don't really have much to compare that to because this is sort of a new scenario. People are adopting or heat pumps. So this is something Roger mentioned to me years ago and sort of stuck in my mind. So anyways, I just feel like that ought to be included in the modeling work, because that could be that's something that magnifies the problem that we already have, which is the multiple day-long winter storm issue. This exacerbates it, I think.
Right. It will be incorporated as we take our load up and down. As we, like those sensitivities, we click our load up and down, it will be modeled in that.
I had a second question. Hold on a second. Let me just remind myself what it was. Regarding hedging. So you've all brought to our attention resource adequacy in the region. And that brings up the question of our hedging strategy, and perhaps we ought to hold back more power on a five-year basis than we currently are. That seems to me, I guess, to be an issue, Susan, that maybe does belong in this 2 to 3 year cycle and not something that should wait till 2024 the next time around. So I'm curious what you have to say about that.
Well, it's a good question, Commissioner Rittal. The resource adequacy question that the region is trying to answer right now is something that will not actually be developed and understandable by us until later in 2021 or in 2022. And so we really don't have a lot of information right now in terms of what would be the obligations. And so I think it is a little premature to try to anticipate a resource adequacy program for the region. But I think the question you're raising about our hedging practices with our resources is something that can be taken up in our traditional risk management procedures.
And not in this cycle of IERP?
No, it would certainly come up in the next cycle of the IRP.
I want to see it in this cycle. go ahead. Let's see. Where are we at? Dick, you haven't had a turn yet.
I'm going to be in listening and kind of aligning mode for a while, because I think from my perspective, if I could just share the way I see the landscape, having been through a number of these processes in the past, I think if I were in staff shoes, I'd be looking at all this and saying, and sort of remarking on the significant amount of uncertainty that exists right now in our industry, not only with respect to electrification, carbon mitigation, and evolving technology, but the other 10 things that were on the list that didn't make the cut for this cycle. I don't see many of the traditional elements of a historically operable IERP process here, and I think what that tells me is that we're not really in a position to line those all up and do the kind of work that we've done in the past that was comprehensive and addressed everything from hedging strategies and risk management to, you know, future resource decisions and the possibility of different Bonneville options. And I think what I take this to mean is that you're biting off a piece of this that will help inform the context in which that unfolds over the course of time as we look at other aspects of this. And so I'm a little disappointed in the what we're not going to accomplish, because I think a lot of those things are things that come out in a full-blown integrated process. But I can also appreciate that we're not in a very good position as staff or as a board, given the amount of change afoot and the number of unknowns in a market context, in a climate context, to take all of that on at once. And so I guess the only question I have then with respect to the three things that we will be taking on is in carbon mitigation. I assume that we're not focused there on just the what to do about the 3% of our portfolio that's caught up with carbon, because that's a relatively simple issue. But the question is more broadly, what does our context begin to look like as the rest of the region takes on its carbon in its portfolio? Because as you can see from these graphs, you know, there's quite a bit of carbon-based resource in the region that will be coming out of the resource stack. And so it's not just about how do we manage the small portion of our portfolio that has a carbon component, but really what does it mean for our portfolio and our operation and our ability to meet load as everybody else's portfolio, some of which supports things like load following and capacity, begin to move out of the landscape. So is that broader view of carbon really what you're intending, as opposed to just focusing on our little 3%?
No, it is definitely. We take a regional look from in all of our analytics, and we incorporate all of the carbon measures that are currently exist, and we will also be looking at the generation resources, and will be anything that has already been decided to taking coal out of the region, that will be incorporated in our analytics as well.
All right, any other questions? Sonia, go ahead.
On the slide where it says what the IRP tells us versus what it doesn't tell us, I think I understand that roughly this is just the model where we can dial it up and dial it down, and there isn't one path forward, but I do hope that we are able to use that model and the dials to, you know, as a board, make assumptions and kind of say this is our risk tolerance, so that we can choose what portfolio mix we will have, because I mean, otherwise I'm not really sure what the point of it is. So saying that it will not tell us our portfolio mix, I get that there's not one path, but I mean, that is the ultimate goal, that we are moving towards using that as a tool so that we can decide what we're going to do with BPA, what we're going to decide to do with the Walterville projects.
Yeah, you have a good point. Yes, one of the things that Jen's going to talk about is the other board work sessions that we've planned. And we're going to be bringing some preliminary analytics back to you, and you're going to be able to ask us those kinds of questions, and we're going to be able to go back and do some various runs and sensitivities.
Okay, thank you.
Frank, go ahead.
I would just add that part of this supply planning is not just about resources. It's about how do we facilitate consumption differently? What products and services do we have in the future that allow for both an economic solution as well as an environmental solution? So when people come to us and say, how much electrification can we handle, or how are we going to handle it, we have the ability to answer those questions. This isn't just about making a decision about Bonneville. Bonneville's 2028, and while we know we need to talk to them about products and services, much before then, there's a lot of things that go into this regarding our ability to handle load and synchronize, look at time of use, look at carbon intensity, which varies through time. And so, well, that's why we've expanded the definition to be electricity supply planning, but it's much more than just an IRP. And so this isn't just about deciding about a resource or a resource mix. There's a lot of other questions that go into it.
I have just one last question. Susan, I think it's really for you. For the duration of this this plan, prior to getting into the next cycle of this, can you imagine a scenario in which we would be, in which we'd find ourselves short of power, needing to go out onto the market to buy, not just because of a storm, but on a more regular basis because of I don't know, extreme electrification, uptake of EVs, whatever else it might be, heat pumps, et cetera. Because I think what you're telling me is, don't worry, that's just not going to happen. We don't have to really worry about that just yet.
No, that's absolutely not what I'm trying to say. But it's not the first time I've misspoken. But no, we are generally resource efficient right now, and that is not going to change. But we are also generally, when there are extreme weather events, like a cold weather event, or in the summer, we're actually starting to see summer peaks now, we do have to go into the market and buy to cover those needs. The resource adequacy project that you and I have been talking about is actually more about making sure that the capacity is available for every responsible entity in the region, and that would include us, to serve those peak needs when they come through. And that will inform our decisions in the next cycle about what sorts of resources we need and where we might want to go to look for them. But it doesn't change anything right now. I don't know if that answered your question, Steve.
To an extent, the question I get most often, and it's from people who are sitting right over here, as a matter of fact, several of them, is what happens if we have, you know, massive amount of electrification for whatever the reason? Are we prepared in the next handful of years to manage that? So I want, coming out of this thing, the ability to say yes, no, this, that. I want the numbers to be able to say, here's what we expect, here's what's happened so far, here's what the extreme case looks like, and here's how we prepared, how we think we would absorb that, because that's the most frequent question that I hear out there.
Well, this first plan, the commissioner should answer those questions. I mean, the electrification issue is really, as Commissioner Helgeson knows, it's a load issue, right, for us. How much of it can we expect? What does it mean for our existing resource situation? What would it potentially compel us to do in the future to acquire the resources necessary to serve that load? There's all those questions get raised and can be answered in this first 2021 IRP. And then we would also have the tools available so that when the board gets these questions from the community, we have the ability to answer them with more factual data.
Okay. Thank you. Go ahead, Frank.
I would say, Steve, that sorry,
that's
President
fine.
Mattel.
Call me Steve. You know,
the part of the analytics is not just to electrify or not to electrify. It's to what extent and to what type and to what shape, and how do we economically and environmentally fulfill that need. So that is it. It's a lot more granular than just, oh, can we handle this or not? This is from a resource perspective. We also want to make sure we're looking at our infrastructure, our transmission and distribution system, and things like that that will support that as well. And so it will be, that is the intent of this first round, looking at the scenarios and the sensitivities to be able to answer that question. It's the most timely question that we're getting, a lot more timely than questions around Bonneville contracts. I would comment on one thing that you mentioned, which is around hedging. Hedging being really a separate way of managing existing resources. We do buy and sell regularly, and we have historically, at least the last 10 years or so, hedged for softness in the market. We have not hedged for the other side of it. And I do think that on an ongoing basis, we need to review our hedging strategy and what we're trying to accomplish with that. It's not necessarily part of an IRP, but it's definitely part of an ESP and how we manage our the operation of our resources.
Dick, go ahead.
One thing that would help me, in light of the fact that it's not entirely clear to me what comes out the other end yet, but I'm trusting that it will be a good journey and a worthy conversation, would be not here tonight because I think we're running close on time for this portion, but in light of the fact that you've got a fairly clear indication of what we're not going to do, I'd like some examples of the kinds of decisions that we would be making as a result of this iteration. So what, in your mind, might be some possible outcomes or decisions that this board might make to set the direction for the future based on these three attributes that we're going to focus on in this iteration? Because that's not altogether clear to me yet from the presentation, and I know once we get into it, it'll be a pretty rich discussion, even in the details of these three things. But if you could, it's always nice as a board to be able to kind of keep our eye on the prize and have a sense of kind of where we're going to try to resolve things in whatever work we're going to do together. And I'm just not very clear about that yet.
Yeah, great. We can do that.
Final comments? All right, I'll just take a quick poll of the board. It's about 10 minutes past. We are, We are half an hour or more ahead of schedule. We have about, a half hour or so remaining in the meeting this evening. We could take our break. We could kind of plow on through. What are people's preferences?
I'm happy to plow on, on through if you're willing to let me make a quick run to the coffee room.
Why don't we take an abbreviated break in that case? We'll take a five-minute recess. We'll be back here at, I don't know, hold on a second, at 12 minutes past. Meeting. Susan, are you about ready to go?
So we try to reach to the thing that we can.
All right, we're going to pick up where we left off. We're going to move into item number 10. That's the 2021 Integrated Resource Plan Engagement Plan. Susan, you are on once again.
Part two, and actually I'm not on. Jen is on. I just in advance, Jen helped us work so well on communicating these ideas, which can be kind of complex, and I just wanted to thank her in advance. So now I get to turn it over to Jen.
Well, on that note, good evening, commissioners. A month ago, I was here talking about water storage improvement projects, and tonight I'm back to discuss another strategic initiative that requires a lot of thoughtful public outreach, the Integrated Resource Plan. Our objectives for tonight are to share the public communication and engagement plan and hear any feedback that you may have. Specifically, if we've missed anything important that's on your radar, and if we've hit the target in terms of the right level and type of public engagement for this IRP cycle. I'd like to start by acknowledging the feedback that the team heard from commissioners during the one-on-one sessions last fall. There were really three important themes from commissioners that guided our communication and engagement plan. One was a sense that the board is elected to represent customers, and the process should respect that role, particularly given the very technical, long-term decisions to be made within the IRP. Second was a desire to educate customers and design an engagement process where the board can receive quality feedback that is grounded and informed to help guide your decision making. Finally, there was an interest in engaging a broad mix of customers, not just those who are already engaged. In addition to understanding your interests up front, an important part of our planning effort is acknowledging a few of the inherent challenges in creating an effective communication and engagement strategy for this work. One is the complexity of the subject matter. There's a lot of data, analysis, modeling, and assumptions that go into an IRP. The process is rife with industry terminology, and it's highly technical work that few people understand well. Personally, I've been at eWeb for going on 22 years, and Megan and Susan and others in their group talk over my head every day. So if you think of a Venn diagram with one circle representing the technical work that has to be accomplished and the other circle representing what stakeholders care about, that overlapping area in the middle is where we have the best opportunity to engage people. Another challenge is the range of stakeholder interests, values, and involvement. This diagram shows our various audiences, which include the customers at large, civic and special interest groups, and others. As part of the IRP and electricity supply planning overall, we have big decisions to make that impact all of our customers. Some of those customers are already informed and deeply interested in this work, and others are not yet aware of the significant role they will have in the future of the electric grid and managing electricity use. We need to reach them all. Also, this is a future-focused, multi-year effort with large pauses in between major milestones in which the focus is on data gathering and analysis. There's not a lot to talk about during these large pauses. Our challenge is to retain stakeholder trust in the process and confidence even when we don't have new information for long periods of time and no short-term call to action. Despite these challenges, we need to get it right, because stakeholder communication and engagement around the IRP directly supports eWeb's strategic plan. The future phases of the strategic plan rely on partnerships with customers. We can use the IRP as a barometer to gauge the current state of customer willingness to partner with us and to influence how customers think about their role in electricity supply planning. For example, understanding how time of use affects the costs and carbon intensity of the grid. And when it comes to educating about managing electricity use and balancing supply and demand, it's important to recognize that this will be a long-term campaign. If we think about eWeb's efficiency education programs as an example, it's taken 20 years of consistent messaging about using less energy and investing in efficiency in buildings for those ideas to really stick and become an inherent part of the community consciousness. We're now going to be talking with customers about the importance of when they use electricity, and that's a new concept for many. It's going to take time to build that understanding. Given this context, we've defined the following communication goals or desired outcomes. So when we look back on this work in a year and a half or so from now, these are the things we want to have achieved. First and foremost, we want to ensure that staff and commissioners hear relevant, actionable stakeholder input that helps inform and guide utility decisions. Secondly, we want to support the strategic plan, and that means beginning to build a foundation of knowledge today that facilitates consumption, flexibility, and grid resiliency in the future. And finally, we want to ensure that customers who choose to engage in the process have opportunities to do so and feel that decision makers have heard their input. Achieving these goals and mitigating the challenges previously discussed will require us to lean into a set of communication principles that will guide our work for the next year and a half and beyond. Number one, we will use compelling messages and themes to simplify complex ideas and help make information stick. This means challenging ourselves to use non-technical language and focusing on how these concepts affect you, the audience, and your life. Recognizing the IRP is a prime opportunity to start developing knowledge of electricity supply and demand broadly across our customer base and developing that knowledge is going to be a long-term process, but we won't gain traction if we don't use words and tools that connect with customers where they are now. Principle number two, understanding that people receive information and learn in different ways, we will cast a broad net, leveraging a variety of communication methods to educate customers and to keep stakeholders informed throughout the process. Number three, we'll create meaningful opportunities for conversation between customers, staff, and the board. In the near future, our electricity customers will become electricity partners. And we can start laying the foundation for that relationship today by inviting customers to partner with us in the IRP process. But that engagement must be meaningful. It must be inclusive, it must be grounded, and it must be actionable so that both the process itself as well as the outcomes have value. Finally, we'll close feedback loops by documenting what we hear and letting participants know how their feedback influenced the work. Most likely, we won't be able to reflect all feedback into the IRP action plan. We need to be straightforward and transparent about that. But what we can do and what we should do is listen, summarize questions and concerns that have been heard, and provide the public with the rationale for decisions in light of all relevant facts and opinions. This step of closing feedback loops is critical to building public trust. So when and how will you have opportunities to listen to public feedback? At this stage, we're focusing on three primary ways for the public to provide input to the IRP. One is participating in board workshops. We anticipate holding three workshops over the next year and a half, and I'll talk about the format for those public sessions in a moment. This channel is, of course, open to all customers and will be widely advertised, but the most likely audience is those highly interested customers who are already pretty informed and engaged. We also need to create opportunities for the general public to learn and to weigh in, and an important channel for that is online. We have a basic website up and running, and we will be enhancing the site with ways for customers to submit comments and to respond to specific questions posed by the utility. The website will be an important tool as well for summarizing and sharing public feedback received throughout the process. And third, we will reach out directly by attending neighborhood, civic, special interest group meetings, and other events. Frank is leading the first of these tomorrow night at the Energy and Planning public presentation, and these events will provide opportunities to inform and to listen. I'd like to note two quick things about this proposed toolbox of engagement methods. One is the three topics that you see on the screen represent our two-way communication tactics, so the listening and informing. In addition, we will leverage a variety of traditional tools such as printed materials and email to inform the broader community of the work we're doing, and you have some examples of those printed materials in your packet tonight. The other point is this team recognizes that there are lots of other ways of engaging the community, everything from mobile apps and surveys to expert panels, and we envision in the future leveraging some of those more innovative outreach methods in coming IRP cycles. For the 2021 IRP, this level of engagement felt appropriate given the direction we've heard so far from commissioners and achievable for the team given our timeline and current resources. But one of the questions we have for you tonight in the discussion part of the agenda is, does this feel like the right level and type of engagement to aid your decision-making during this IRP cycle? So let's wrap up by spending a few moments diving into what we think the board workshops might look like. The workshops would be off-cycle from regular board meetings and planned around key project milestones shown on the left, with the first being in April, April 14th. The workshops would be structured to facilitate a learning and listening process. The format would include opening presentations from staff, then a facilitated discussion between the board and staff, which is intended to allow commissioners to discuss and debate topics with each other and with staff. Each workshop will have a specific goal and a set of questions to address and will be facilitated by an outside consultant. Following the presentation and discussion, there would be opportunity for informal Q&A between customers, commissioners, and staff. The informal Q&A might be similar to what we've done in the past for Upriver board meetings. So why are we proposing this format and what are the benefits? One is efficient use of time and resources. In past IRPs, we've formed a customer panel, and staff has invested a great deal of time and resources to educate those select folks on electricity supply issues and then feed that panel's input back to the board. And this was appropriate at the time, but this new structure is more streamlined and consistent with our new format of updating the IRP on more frequent 2 to 3 year cycles. It also respects the board's role as elected policymakers and gives you opportunity to hear feedback directly from customers to support your decision making. It facilitates informed feedback from participants by putting the dialogue portion at the end of the agenda. And finally, it's transparent, with discussions happening in an open public forum. So that's it for me. These are some questions that we've teed up, but we're really just ready to hear from you, thoughts and questions and ideas that you have. Thank you.
All right, well, thank you for the presentation, Jen. I'll open up a queue once again. Looks like Sonia wants to jump in first. Go ahead.
So in the first level there in April, what kinds of information are you envisioning that we would give you that we haven't already? Part of what I'm struggling with right now is that there's not a lot to dig your teeth into until those dials and the model is put together and you can really kind of set boundaries on assumptions. And it sounds like the modeling portion and all of those dials get set after that meeting. So are you looking for what dials to put in the model and the April meeting, or is it more than that? Because I feel like we've given a lot of input about what dials are on there, and you've kind of noted a lot of that feedback already in the work. So I'm struggling a little bit with that piece. You can help me.
So we're in the process of figuring out and planning that April work session. Okay. As part of that planning process, we're going to be providing you with background information that's going to help you answer the questions that we will tee up at that time.
Okay.
That doesn't satisfy your question.
It's really hard for me to give feedback because I'm not really sure what exactly.
Right.
You're looking for. I mean, it feels like we've given a lot of feedback about these are the general concerns, and then the staff really need to go and say, okay, well, this dial has this range, and if we dial it all the way this way, this is the impact. And until we have that modeling work, the discussion to me really isn't very substantive.
And
that's what I'm struggling with and trying to give you feedback.
I want to make sure I say the right thing. So Megan, if I misspeak, please let me know. But my understanding is you will have a lot of things to discuss by the April workshop. We can't tell you specifically tonight what those things will be, but you will be receiving lots of material from the team in the coming weeks to start teeing up that discussion to give you a lot to think about and to clarify what questions we'll be posing to the board in April.
I'm just going to jump in.
I'll take your word.
It's vague.
Jump in real quick and give. I think the question or the feedback we're getting from Sonia really picks up on comments Dick made in the last session, where it's clear, you know, all the information that's going in. It's not clear, you know, the actionable things coming out that we need to make decisions about. So that's what I'm hearing from Sonia. Dick, go ahead.
So like others on the board, I'm first of all, I want to say. On this piece, and actually the earlier piece in terms of the general form of things, I'm comfortable with what you're bringing us. I'm let down a little bit on the substance on the first part of the presentation, only because my hope would be to take a little more on than that in the last year of my tenure on the board. But it's been so long since we've had a chance to work on this together that I'm looking forward to it, and I think in general the structure looks workable, and I like the strategy for public engagement. But I, like others, am still kind of feeling pretty amorphous about what we're about yet. So I'm going to just trust that you're in the lead. You've heard what we've had to say about the structure and our interests, and you're going to bring us something substantive to chew on, and the proof will be in the pudding. So I'm going to suspend my anxiety about that and gauge as we move forward whether we're accomplishing what we would hope to accomplish. And I don't think until you – so you make the first play, and then we'll have something to talk about, I guess is kind of where I'm left. And I understand that it's about those three things principally, and I imagine that gets pretty complicated even though we start with just three. So, but I, too, am feeling a little uncomfortable about lacking the clarity about exactly where we're going with this. But I don't think until we get into it, we're going to figure that out, or you're going to even really be able to tell us.
Go ahead, Mindy.
So to piggyback on that, I guess my feedback is just to be aware and be mindful in messaging this out to the community, since we're a little confused, so that community members don't think that this process is something different. I know that you're doing a really good job of laying everything out. But if we're up here a little bit confused, community members or special interest groups or civic groups might think that they're going to be giving input on some actionable immediate items.
Thank you for saying that. I think we all agree with that. I think if we want to get informed feedback, we have to ask the right questions. And so we'll be doing a lot of work to define those in between now and April.
John, go ahead.
So I'm going to join their club, and I've been listening and trying to understand. So tell me, you know, I'm kind of big on going to the people and saying, trying to keep it dummy, and thank you very much for taking the 22-year hit. I've been at 15, and I still don't understand it. But so when and where in this timeline do we engage the public down in the layman terms to communicate with them? Do I go to wards 4 and 5 and listen to the ratepayers in those two wards where is that in this timeline?
We can support you anytime that you are wanting to go out and participate in meetings and events in your ward.
When do I have that information to take to them that I can say, what do you think?
So I feel like we keep circling around this issue of what's going to be talked about in April. I'm going to take a stab at clarifying that, and this is really where I need you to jump in. Is it?
Can I offer something?
Oh.
I've been sitting on quite a bit.
Will, please come to the table.
Take over or whatever, but I feel your anxiety, and I want to address the anxiety. So, for example, April 14th, from this, we're talking about like these multiple three scenarios that we want to look at, right? So just take the first one, climate forward. For example, we could look at what we want to do is talk to you about what our research, what we found, what these dial parameters should look like. For example, climate forward, climate change legislation. Say it's cap and trade. There's different pricing structures one could overlay on that, right? So if I have a very weak price on carbon, that's not going to drive electrification very well, one could imagine. If I had a moderately strong price, you're going to get more and more electrification. If I use the cost of carbon, for example, which is probably four times what the California CARB base floor would be, as to kind of look in that jaws of ranges, what we want to do, for example, and I'm just picking one little example, is come to you and say, this is what we've researched. These are the reasonable things, and this is why we think it's reasonable. Here are all the sources that we have, and here's what we plan on using. Does this make sense to you? Right. So we want to engage you often as we go through this process so that you're on board with everything that we've done, and we've given you the research and the background for you to say, yes, that is a fantastic direction that you're going. Or, hey, you're missing something. Have you thought about this? So we want to get feedback, the way I see it is 90% of it is education to say, you know, to bring you along with our, with why do you think this is a rational, you know, direction and boundaries and dials and sensitivities and all that. But we want to hear feedback as to, you know, have you got this? Have you, you missed that? I hear this about this in California. I hear that. We want to have that kind of open engagement. Or another thing, like electrification. You brought up these great concerns about what if we have all these heat pumps and, you know, and hot water heaters and our peaks go up, right? We want to be able, so we've got end-use modeling tools that we have 8760 hourly profiles that we can, and we know, you know, we've segmentized our, you know, our service territory into how many commercial buildings and residential by vertical market segment and what happens. We can play all these what ifs and share those with you to show you what would happen to load on an hourly basis. What would this, and we can also talk about resource adequacy on a high level basis. We won't know what resource adequacy is from an obligation until the Northwest Power Pool actually dictates what those metrics are, which we won't know for a couple of years.
So, Will, could I summarize what I think, if I understand this right, and what I was just going to say exactly what you just said, but to bring it down, what I believe is going to happen is we're going to come to you in April with the dashboard, with the dials, and say, these are the dials that we're going to play with, and this is sort of the range of sensitivities that we're going to be studying, and are these the right dials? Is the range of sensitivities that we are going to study, does it align with what you think might happen? And that's where those kind of background materials come in. We're thinking like white paper type documents that have a lot of educational material on electrification trends and things like that. So we'll come to you with a proposed dashboard and ask you to weigh in. And that will really be the meat of the discussion in April. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yep, Frank, I'm going to ask you to kind of tie this up a little bit for us, so we need to move on.
Yeah, I was going to paraphrase this, that the next step, which includes the board and the public outreach, is that within each of these first three scenarios, we will tell you what the variables are, and we will tell you the range of those variables and why. And then we can, so that we can ensure with the board that there is consistency as to what we're including or excluding, what the drivers are, so that when we come up with a range of solutions and options, you understand the basis for the assumptions. I think that's the details of those assumptions.
Any additional questions at this point? I anticipate there will be going forward. Go ahead, Sonia.
Okay, well, thank you. That helps a lot, because it wasn't clear to me initially whether or not we were giving feedback into the dials and the range, or if the model itself was the dials and the range, because the outcome to me seems like just having the model itself, not we dial it all in and then it makes one path forward based on what you said earlier. So I'm only saying that because as we communicate to the public, right, I think it's probably helpful to have that feedback about the perception. So thank you, that really helps me, and I'm supportive of the plan and the scope of how to move forward, knowing that that's the ultimate goal. Thank you.
Dick, go ahead.
So I'm looking forward to moving the process ahead. I guess what just triggered for me is to remember that it's not about the model. It's about how the model informs our conversation and our understanding of the world that we live in and how that might change going forward, and how that affects the landscape that we have to make decisions in. And so I hope we don't get mired down. I mean, I think the model is good stuff, and it will help illuminate kind of what all this means. But really what's important in all this is the conversation and the understanding that comes out of it. And in order for that to happen, you got to get on the dance floor and start the dance. And we're not yet there tonight. So we'll crank the music up and start that process, I guess, in April. And in the meantime, we'll be getting some cue cards and some other stuff that might help us not step on each other's toes.
Well, thank you for that, Dick. right, we're gonna move on. I'm sure we'll hear more about this topic in the coming months. So item number 11 is correspondence and board agendas. Frank, that's you.
President Mattel, there is no correspondence tonight, and so that is easy. There are a number of things just noteworthy. The March meeting, we have a guest coming who is the administrator of Bonneville Power Administration. So Elliot will be spending most of that day with us, actually visiting some customers, talking about products, strategy, resource adequacy, a number of different issues. And he is scheduled to present to the board and have a dialogue with the board and answer questions. And so if there's things specific that you would... specifically that you would like to hear from Elliot Mainzer, please either reach out or bring those up at our one-on-one check-ins. Also, really an encapsulated, detailed summary also of 2019, where we landed on a number of the metrics and the goals as a follow-on to the state of the utility, which fed into some of that, but in more detail as to where we landed. And also, it's listed as correspondence, but there may be some discussion around the drinking water source protection plan that is scheduled. And I would welcome feedback as to whether we want to make that an agenda item for discussion or whether we would just do that through through correspondence and then discuss when we could discuss it during correspondence. I know where one commissioner is.
I think the consent calendar would be.
So those are the highlights generally. Any questions?
Thank you. We'll just go on right down the line. John, do you want to start? If you have anything to say, you don't have to.
Board wrap up.
Yep.
I noticed it's public now that Phillips is leaving the building, and that's a $600,000 a year swing for us financially. And I don't know if that's going to be board decision on what our next steps are, if we're going to try and mitigate that or whatever, but I think it may change how we look at what's going on there. So,
absolutely, we haven't had direct contact with Phillips yet. We know that there's some a deadline coming up relative to notice to the end of the lease. I think I provided the board with at least a general lease update as part of my correspondence. Any decision going forward, whether we seek further renters or whether it makes the building more attractive to sell, we will have that. That'll be a board directional decision, Commissioner. We are also becoming well positioned to move most of our people to the Rock who were planned to move within the next month or so, and then we would. One of the things I wanted to ask commissioners is to whether. And this could be, I don't know whether this would be head nods, whether we could start looking for another facility potentially in combination with the credit union on an opportunistic basis. And what we would look for is something like an old bank or something to where we could completely vacate this facility. That's one of those issues that if you look, you could find something in a month, it could take 5 years. But it would be something that if the board wanted to start the looking process, we could initiate that. But, Commissioner, this building would be, and the status of this building would be a board decision.
You want to say anything about drinking water?
Well, we're really not just going to make that a consent calendar or just a correspondence, are we?
Apparently not.
I can feel
Carl breathing down my neck
Carl
as we
up
speak.
There, yeah. And I, so. You know, like I say, 4 out of the 5 most important things surveyed by our customers is drinking water. And why would we not do that? I know electricity gets 85% of the time, but I'm going to pound the drum pretty loud and pretty hard to make sure that stays in the forefront of. That's why I'm here. Thank
we
you.
Appreciate
I
that
think
very
we all
much.
Know that. All right.
Yes.
Drinking water plan will be discussed. Commissioner Carlson.
I have nothing to add. Thanks.
I'm feeling complete.
Okay.
Nothing to add.
All right. And I am also feeling done. All right. Thank you, everybody. The meeting is adjourned.
Yeah.